Hello, Mel, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Randy. Thank you for having me today, and I'm very glad to be here.
At what point in your life did you know that you wanted to become a musician, Mel?
I knew from the age of 14 that I wanted to become a musician. I had already started performing and was playing jazz, listening to jazz regularly, practicing really hard, and it was just one of those things that one knows one becomes aware that that's the direction you want to go in. I guess you could say I heard the calling at that age.
Do you remember what the first concert was that you attended, and what kind of impression did this leave on you?
I'm not sure what the first concert I ever attended was, but the one that left the main impression on me early on, well, there were several, but the first one was going to hear Benny Goodman and a big band live at the Memorial Auditorium in Sacramento, and he had people like Mousy Alexander, Leroy Vinegar, Bud Johnson on tenor, and Hank Jones on piano. It was really an incredible band, and everybody sounded great. And I know I was very impressed with Bud Johnson's sound. He just had this big, robust tenor sound and just stood out. When he played, you know it got played. And that was an important thing. I also heard Count Basie's big band from the 50s with Joe Williams singing, and Frank Foster and Frank West, Marshall Royal, Snooky Young, and so many other people, Sonny Payne. And that was that great band. And they were playing for a dance. And I remember going right up to the bandstand and just hanging out and just kind of really digging on the band. Could go look right at them and see what was going on. And there were many other musicians. One of the musicians in that band at that time was Benny Powell, who I later actually toured with Benny Carter in Japan in the early 90s. But it was an incredible experience, because just to hear those guys playing for a dance. And, of course, they did April in Paris, and Thad Jones was there and played that famous trumpet solo. Afterwards, I went up to him and said, gee, Mr. Jones, it just sounded so great. I was just so glad to hear you. And he says, did you really think so? And it just, I got so turned around that a musician would wonder if I really thought he sounded good, when I would think he would know he sounded so good. But I think it showed he had a lot of humility, is what that showed. Plus, he'd think he had to play the same solo every night, so it probably was a big question for him. I also got to hear Duke Ellington's big band and orchestra at the California State Fairgrounds one summer, and I walked into this little outdoor theater, and there they were. Harry Carney was there, and Paul Gonsalves, and Cat Anderson, and so many of those guys. Johnny Hodges wasn't there. Willie Smith was playing lead alto, the great Willie Smith, who I'd also heard with Harry James' big band. We used to drive up to Lake Tahoe and go hang out at the clubs where Harry James' band was playing, because he had Buddy Rich with him, and he was the highest paid sideman in the world at that time. And Willie Smith was lead alto in that band. But in anyway, with Duke Ellington's band, there was also a drummer I later got to work with, Dave Black, who had kind of taken Louis Belson's place and was doing things like Skin Deep. And, of course, Harry Carney was there. And they came out and did all their songs, all the famous songs that we've been listening to. And it was just quite a thrill, an amazing thrill. I also heard Woody Herman's band out there. And then there was concerts at the Senator Hotel in Sacramento, downtown, right near the Capitol, that featured players like Shelly Mann, bands like Shelly Mann and His Men, The Master Sounds, and Stan Kenton, Les Brown and His Band of Renowned, and all those things were influences. They really made a big difference in my burgeoning thoughts about playing music and jazz, and it just seemed very natural to have all that in your environment. Now, I would think that that would be very peculiar for most people, to have that much good music in their environment, because most people really don't anymore. there was also a couple of places to play up there, a club called the Iron Sandal, which was kind of what you would refer to as a beatnik coffee house, and another place called the Orange Villa, which was an after-hours joint, and another place called the Swinging Lantern. And I heard the great guitarist Wes Montgomery and his brothers, Montgomery Brothers, playing in some of these places. They actually came and stayed in Sacramento when they weren't working down in the San Francisco area or traveling elsewhere. They actually kind of got centered in Sacramento and was around, so I would hear them. And I remember walking up to Wes Montgomery one time and asking him for the changes to West Coast Blues, because I thought that was just such a cool song. And he graciously wrote them down on a napkin for me, and I have no idea where that napkin is to this day, but since I never throw anything away, somebody may discover it when they go through all the boxes of stuff I have in my closets. But I also got to sit in with him at one point, and he allowed me to come up and play a set with him on when I asked, which I always did. And I never remembered sounding so good up till then. It was amazing that when you play with musicians so much better than you, how it makes you sound good. Although it may be an illusion, eventually I could sound that good more consistently, let's say. So those were really quite important formulative experiences for me.
While attending San Francisco State, you decided to pursue a career in music. Now, what made you decide that this was the path that you wanted to take?
Actually, I knew I wanted to pursue a career in music long before I went to San Francisco State. And they weren't actually a lot of help there. There was some good music classes. I studied classical flute there and some composition, but mostly it was a school where people were going to study to get their teaching degrees. However, there was a lot of music outside San Francisco State, right on the streets in San Francisco. But before that, I had gone to high school and even junior college in Sacramento, and our high school band in Sacramento is worth talking about. It featured players such as Rufus Reed, who was actually a trumpeter at that time, and drummer Vince Ladiano, and saxophonist named Bob Steen, who went on to work in New York in the studios, and many other musicians who were fine musicians. And it was organized very well by a instructor named Aubrey Penman, who's still up there and still very active. And we just had a very top-notch jazz band. We did shows, we did concert band, we did plays. I got to compose music. I got to do doubling on every instrument that I eventually played professionally. And it really set a whole thing in motion. We even made some records, of which they are rarities and collector's items. So I knew from that point that I really wanted to pursue a career in music. The times I'm talking about in San Francisco was pretty much a heyday of jazz there, because there were a lot of major clubs where people could go hear music. Even when I still lived in Sacramento, I'd come down to the old Blackhawk and remember very well hearing Miles Davis with Hank Mobley and J.J. Johnson and Wynton Kelly, hearing Vince Guaraldi and Cal Jader, and a lot of the bands that were playing regularly at that time. While going to San Francisco State, there were after-hours places. The Fame Bop City was one, and another place called Soulville. And I used to hang out a lot with Eddie Henderson, and we'd go hang out after, on a weekend, we'd start going from one club to another. Could start out at 9 o'clock on a Friday and go sit in on somebody's gig and then go play two after hours places. You could just sort of go back and forth between 2 and 6, and then between 6 and 11 there were clubs like Jack's on Fillmore, which had organ trios. That's where I met Merle Saunders and Eddie Moore, his cousin, the drummer, and got to play with people like Jimmy McGriff and Groove Holmes, who had actually even met in Sacramento before that. So the real education was out on the streets, because you would never know who you'd end up with on a bandstand in the middle of the night or at 6 in the morning. It could be somebody really great, and you could really be doing something. So you really had to do your homework and practice and be prepared. And unfortunately, the kind of stuff they were trying to give us at San Francisco State didn't offer me the same good vibes and the same kind of information that I could get elsewhere. So eventually dropped out of that, got married, and started to work professionally in San Francisco, which put me up on a very famous street named Broadway, where there was a lot of action. As I was a young man, just starting out a family and a family life, I would play regularly in burlesque houses, strip joints. But across the street was the Jazz Workshop, up the street was Basin Street West, and down the street was the El Matador. So at any given time, You could see Miles, you could see Dizzy, you could see Basie, Sonny Rollins, just everybody you can think of that was touring at that time was playing on that street. So at any given point, an intermission or after the gig, or you could run into Moody or somebody up on the street, and it was really quite a golden time for the music. And then on off nights, I would just go down and hear the great players and really keep making those connections. So that was really quite some great times in early San Francisco. Unfortunately, it isn't the same as it once was. So now we travel to play music, and most of the greats are gone.
Mel, do you remember your first gig as a pro?
My first gig as a pro, that's kind of hard to define. It's the first gig where I ever received money for playing. It was that my father got me a gig with my little trio, which included me on clarinet and Sam Lombardo on accordion and Lawrence Yerby on drums. And we played on the back of a flatbed truck for a supermarket opening and made $5 each. And that was big money. That was actually more than I made on some other gigs. However, that was fun, and I used to have a little band. We'd go around playing dances, and then afterwards we'd often go down to Mel's Drive-In and set up and play after the dance gig, and people would pass the hat around, and we'd make a little more money down there. So it was always something to do, and there was a lot of professional stuff. By the time I was about 16, 17, I joined the Musicians Union there and started playing with more adult bands, which was great experience. And then I had a good saxophone teacher named Bud Harfum, who also had a dance band, and I would play with him, and his fellas were all really well-experienced performers and repairmen even. They showed me how to run a light through my saxophone and adjust it and keep it working well, and I learned an awful lot that way. And Bud would tutor me out of the universal saxophone method and so forth. So I got a really strong background, and I guess I was learning while I was earning, if not burning. But the one gig that really stood out in my mind in early Sacramento was when Frank Sinatra put together a show to play for the Pat Brown inaugural party when Frank Sinatra was still a Democrat, and he brought up Dean Martin and Dorothy Dandridge, I remember, and I don't remember if Sammy Davis was there, but he had a lot of people who he normally worked with in shows, and they all brought their books, and I got to play with a band that was mostly L.A. guys and featured people like Abe Most and Jack Sperling on drums and Ralph Pina on bass and Zeke Zarchi on trumpet and Milt Bernhardt on trombone, and Jack Nimitz was there on Barry. And I sat next to a guy named Babe Rusin, who was the tenor player that was on all the early Benny Goodman recordings that I had listened to, Sing, 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 and so forth. And so that was quite a thrill. And so there I was, a 17-year-old kid, getting to play with all these professionals, and myself and a couple of other local musicians got to play in that band. And it was really... that was my most professional experience, to play with these really top-notch L.A. guys who were all big band veterans of the highest degree and the highest caliber. And then Sinatra came out finally, and we did his show, and that was like my first experience at real magic on stage, because the lights would come down, spotlight would hit him, he'd go into one of his songs, and the audience just melted. He would just do something about the way he sang those words and his own stage presence. It just was pure magic. So to be a part of that was really quite some kind of professional experience. And again, set the background for the kinds of experiences I would have later on in San Francisco, playing a lot of shows and playing with a lot of the great artists.
You know, one of the most important aspects of being a jazz musician is what they can learn that will help them out musically. What did you learn from your years playing with the likes of Santana, Van Morrison, and even some of the other musicians during this period in your life?
One of the most important aspects of being a jazz musician is, in fact, learning on the bandstand. And your question concerning... what did I learn playing with Santana, Van Morrison, and other musicians during this period is not nearly as relevant as to what did I learn playing with people like John Hendricks and Wes Montgomery and the many jazz musicians I played with. because those were the real teachers. Playing jazz music was far more challenging and of major interest to me. By the time I played with those other artists, we were in the middle of what we called the kind of rock revolution in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. And it was quite a trip to be around all those players and to be making those records that I made and using my jazz abilities. I think maybe they learned a little more from me than I learned from them, if anybody was learning anything. I think we were mostly having a pretty good time and trying to make as many gigs as we could. There were a lot of recording dates, and in the early 70s I began to tour with bands like Boz Scaggs and Cold Blood, and later on Azteca. I did a couple of records with Santana and sat in with him on occasion, and he played with some of the bands I was playing with on occasion, but we never really I never really worked in his band per se. Van Morrison I did work with a little bit. But I was the only horn player, and he normally has a couple of horn players, a couple of saxophone players playing these little parts that are on all his tunes, which if you don't play them, the tunes tend to all sound the same. But I was just having a good time just playing jazz. I don't think he had as good a time as I had, actually. Although I liked Van, he came over and tried to take a saxophone lesson from me one time, and that was interesting. We didn't really quite click for long term. I could have done it more. They asked me to work with them. By that time, I was playing with Azteca, which was a jazz, rock, Latin kind of huge project that eventually got on CBS Records, and we made two albums with that band, and it had people like Lenny White and Tom Harrell and Paul Jackson and Flip Nunez and many others, some of whom are no longer with us. But it was a really great experience, and the times were great. It was a time when almost anything would go, and you could be very creative with how you input it into what was essentially a different kind of situation. We weren't talking about acoustic jazz anymore. We're talking about electric bands and rock bands, which eventually influenced jazz quite a bit at that point as well. There were bands around like Mike Knox Fourth Way, Jerry Hahn Brotherhood. And eventually I started a band called Listen, which was an acoustic fusion band. That's when fusion wasn't a dirty word and didn't have just sort of mechanical beats to it. It had very musical beats, and many of which were odd times and those kinds of things. So it was a good time, but it wasn't a time so much to learn. I learned more what not to do than what to do. About music. Yeah, that music influenced me. It influenced me mainly in the way I wrote music, because I would attempt to write music for some of those situations. But my real roots were jazz, and that's what eventually I came back to.
Was your childhood filled with music?
My childhood, if not filled with music, certainly had a lot of music in it. My mother taught me piano at 5, and she would often play the piano, not really well, but she would play, and she had a voice. It was a pretty good, strong, operatic type of voice, and she eventually sang in the choir there in Sacramento, and I would go and listen to that, and I would go to the symphony concerts. My father could sing, but not professionally or anything. We had a piano, so I always had that there. I had music. I built hi-fis, early hi-fis. I built myself, played those little records with the big holes in them. And that's some of the first records I got, Benny Goodman and Count Basie and Lester Young. And our schools had very good music programs, so they were always active. There would be a lot of concertizing and a lot of things to be involved in, like marching band. And they all had dance bands and jazz bands. So we called them dance bands because you'd essentially play for dances, which is not a foreign concept. Jazz is dance music and should be dance music. So those were good experiences, and music seemed to be a very natural part of my life and something I could always excel at. And tried sports a little bit. That wasn't too good. I could high jump a little bit and play a little basketball. But eventually music took all my time, and girls, but mostly music. Okay.
Many years ago, you were part of a band called Listen. At the time, what were you trying to bring to the table musically?
I wasn't actually just a part of a band called Listen. I formed the band and was essentially the leader. although it had some very strong input from George Marsh on drums and Andy Norell on steel drums and piano, Dave Kramer on guitar, Dave Dunaway on bass, and two percussionists, one named Glenn Cronkite and another named Richard Waters, who actually was a musical sculpturist who invented many of the things that the instruments that he was using, called water phones, and then they came in all different shapes and sizes, and eventually those, and even at that time, but they became very popular in motion picture scoring and soundtracks, especially when somebody was about to be mangled or something, because it would always be very eerie and creepy. They also kind of sounded like whales underwater, which isn't a creepy thing, but there you have it. At that time, that music was, as I mentioned earlier, called creative fusion. It was an extension of the idea that you do things that weren't essentially bebop. I mean, it wasn't anti-bebop, it just wasn't bebop. It was other stuff, other kinds of music, and some of it was based on rock beats, but not all of it. Some of it was based on world beats, sambas and other Latin configurations, and having the steel drums kind of gave us an exotic sound, but we used them in different ways, especially with the formulation of odd time compositions, which George Marsh was such a master at teaching us how to play in odd times. We used to drill in every conceivable time signature, literally as a group practice, just to get functional in all these different things. So that was a very important, and I didn't necessarily think so at the time, but later I really believe it was a very innovative band doing things that other bands actually picked up on too, Oregon being one of them, and other bands that had kind of dug what we were doing in our sound, but we were artistically kind of not really even that commercial, although our albums were fairly popular, and in fact at one point Clive Davis was very interested in signing us to Arista, and people were interested, I guess, due to the pop background that I had in other bands and the fact that there was not that many bands doing what we were doing. A lot of the jazz musicians were starting to use Fender Rhodes piano, wear love beads, and get afros and stuff, so that became more common then. But we had a run of a few years where we were literally inventing new music, music that hadn't been played with instruments that hadn't really been recorded that much, and in a way putting it together in a way that was new and different, and that is the definition of innovation. Unfortunately, it couldn't keep together, because to teach people to play music that was so complicated after other people would leave was an impossibility. It just wasn't in the cards to work out. So I eventually dropped that direction because it just seemed to me to kind of run into a dead end, as most fusion music was by a certain point in the late 70s. It had become so commercialized. Listen was on the Inner City label, which also had a band called Jeff Lorber Fusion, which had a saxophone player named Kenny Gorlick. And Jeff Lorber's first record really took off, and it was a very small New York label run by Irv Kratka that when that record started hitting like 50,000 sales, it kind of blew the fuses around there, because they weren't really capable of handling anything that large. Eventually, Jeff Lorber had to go on to a larger label that could handle the kind of sales that he was getting. But that became the beginning of what I kind of refer to as more mechanicalized or commercialized or industrialized fusion. It had all those eyes things going on in it. But mainly it was rhythmically rather stagnant. It wasn't really that interesting. And although those records really kind of hit pretty hard. But that took the steam out of things like what we were doing, because the record company couldn't really get behind us as much as they should have and would have even if they hadn't had those other situations to deal with. So it was an interesting time, and one I would have liked to have seen bear a little more fruit, but it really didn't. But later on, I just had to move back to my acoustic jazz roots. And fortunately, in the early 80s, a lot of that came back due to a young man named Wynton Marsalis, who just began to get a high profile for whatever reason. I remember hearing him early on with Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams and Ron Carter. And he was, I remember being backstage at one of their gigs, and he was just kind of like he is now, and he was started lecturing anybody within earshot of what this should be, that should be, and how blah, blah, blah. And later on, I caught him a little bit with Art Blakey, and he really was kind of out of his, you know, out of his league. And I think he's since admitted he didn't have a real clue as to what he was doing. He kind of felt a little bit embarrassed about it. But he should have stayed there longer, I think. He should have stayed, he should have kept his apprenticeship going a lot longer, and perhaps he would have been a better jazz musician than it appears he has turned out. I always liked his classical trumpet playing, though. I don't know much about it, but when I hear it, I really like it, and I think his brother is a wonderful player. But those guys tended to be responsible for a resurgence in acoustic jazz. I mean, all the jazz musicians were still around and still playing. Not all of them, but a lot of them were still playing, and it kind of brought the attention back to that. And it brought to the attention back from the record companies that could, in fact, find that they could sell some records that way. So it wasn't a bad deal all around.
Now, you had a chance to work with the great trumpet player Dizzy Gillespie on your tribute album to him. Was this the first time that you worked together?
I have to say that working with Dizzy Gillespie was a highlight of my jazz career. I may go on to my dying day looking at it that way, unless some really good things happen. But those guys aren't coming back. Dizzy's not coming back, and Benny Carter is still with us, but he's no longer playing, so I don't get to have the joy. I can call him up on the phone. I love that, but I can't have the joys that I have of playing with him and the joy I had playing with Dizzy. I have to say, playing with people of that stature had to be about as much fun as you can have with your clothes on. It was just amazing. Even as late in his life as it was with Dizzy, he was 73 when we recorded together, he consented to record with us because he had heard the previous records we'd done, and his manager, Charles Fishman, highly recommended us to him, and that we had gotten an NEA grant to record all his compositions. So we took the opportunity to record mostly lesser-known compositions, although Con Alma certainly isn't a lesser one, and Manteca, but there were some other ones. That's Earl Brother, and his theme song, which he sang, I Waited for You. That was his big band theme song from the 40s, and he was just absolute thrilled to be in the studio and to sense the kind of depths he would go to play a musical idea. You could just feel him. He didn't really have the trumpet chops he used to have, obviously, but I believe that record was commended for some of his best latter-day playing, and it in fact turned out to be his final studio date. He did do some live recording after that, before he died at the Blue Note and so forth, but that was his final studio date, as far as I know. And he was, I thought he really played some beautiful music on that date. It was just a wonderful thrill to listen to him. I had always been in awe of Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, I'd been around him. I had met him. I had never played with him. I remember being down at Stanford doing a workshop one time, and I was sitting in the auditorium, and he just sort of wandered in. He was part of the workshop, and I would see him, but he really didn't say much to me. You know, he didn't know who I was or what I did, really, even though I tried to give him one of my albums and so forth. But he sat down and started playing the piano, and there was an education I'll never forget right there. For about an hour, I had my ears in a grand piano while Dizzy Gillespie just simply started playing. And he learned a lot from Thelonious Monk. He really knew a lot about chords and voicings and ways to go about things. And he sounded a lot like Monk at the piano, interestingly enough. Later on, we'd have discussions, extended discussions. I mean, talking 2 years discussions of how you look at half-diminished chords. And I've even got some of those discussions from the studio of us still talking about it while we were recording. So Dizzy, of course, was the master and a great person to be around once you really got to know him, and he got to know you a little bit. If he didn't know you a little bit, you might not get much from him. But that was an absolute thrill for me.
How involved was Dizzy in the arrangements of the tunes?
Dizzy actually didn't have anything to do with arranging the tunes. I did all the arrangements myself and took kind of synopsis, for instance, with Manteca off one of my favorite versions. It had a little more radical harmonization to it as opposed to the original. We had also done some big band work together, concert for Jazz in the City here, and recreated many of his great Latin big band charts with him playing, as well as him playing with our group. We did this all at about the same time we recorded together. So I had a good idea of the kinds of things, but I wanted to just simply adapt his music to what we were doing, which was basically three horns plus him. Thing was, we only had about maybe 5 minutes rehearsal, literally, for the record date with him. We had rehearsed, and I got together with him and played him some tapes of the rehearsals. And in fact, he skipped a baseball game he was invited to go to check out those tapes. So music did come first with Dizzy Gillespie. But the thing was, he really dug what we were doing with it, and he dug the arranging, and he dug the whole vibe of it, and felt very, very comfortable, which was the biggest compliment you could have. And at the rehearsal, he kind of looked at our trumpet player, Warren Gale, and he goes, "You look just like Arturo." Because he kind of does. He looked like Arturo Sandoval. But we just went over a couple of things. He liked the backgrounds for I Waited for You. He really dug that and sang it. And in the studio, he sang it. And that was one of the only times I can ever remember getting goosebumps during a take. Because he would sing it, and we actually ended up overdubbing the horn parts afterwards because we didn't want to leak into his microphone. But we were all listening to him sing, and he got this one take, and it was just incredible, and that was clearly the one we used. After he got it all completed, he says, "Yeah, I like that. I'm going to go call my wife."
What is it about Dizzy's compositional skills that you respect so much?
Well, everybody knows that Dizzy Gillespie has written some great compositions, obviously Night in Tunisia being one of the top ones, and Benny Carter actually remembers him fooling around with those two chords, the D minor to the E flat, and D minor to the E flat, and then making the tune. Actually, it's the E flat to the D minor, in that order. And his compositions are kind of like silly putty because you can almost do things with them. You can make them go in all kinds of different directions, really. I think he was maybe the first real fusion jazz musician. He certainly was the first one that fused Latin music with real modern bebop jazz, hardcore jazz, and made it happen and made it even a popular kind of thing. He did some great things with that, and people like Chano Pozzo and Mario Bauza and these people were involved. So he would always have this strain running through his music that really worked well with Latin jazz. So he was really maybe the first fusion musician that fused various kinds of music. I know he was always interested, and he later on did stuff with the samba and the Brazilian beats and those kinds of things. I think that's probably the fundamental beauty of Dizzy Gillespie as a musician and as a composer, is the fact that everything he does is based strongly in rhythm. He told me he might miss notes now and then, and he did, but he never missed rhythm. He always understood rhythm, he always dealt with rhythm, and that was perhaps the biggest lesson that anybody around him ever learned, is that you better deal with the rhythm first, that you improvise in rhythm and you improvise notes, but rhythm's first. And that is the one that got to me about him. I don't think that Dizzy was ever considered in the same league of a composer as, say, Monk or even Charlie Parker, but he was a great composer, and I have a whole pile of music that John Faddis went through his basement and found a lot of lead sheets of tunes, many of which weren't even recorded. That's kind of how we came up with that song, Diddy Wah Diddy, which is actually even an older blues song called Diddy Wah Diddy. It had nothing to do with that, but we found a lot of music that was either recorded once and discarded or not recorded at all, and he had a lot of, you know, interesting things that were just sort of lying around, never really got taken care of. So, you know, as a composer, he was a great composer. As a trumpet player, he was the monster of all times at his peak. But even at the end, he was really hitting it hard. What a great player and man.
Are there any musicians that you would love to play with but have not had an opportunity to?
I would have loved to play with Count Basie's band, just about any period. I would have loved to play with Duke Ellington's band, just about any period. I would have loved to play with Miles Davis. I would have loved to play with Gil Evans. I would have loved to play with a whole lot of people that were doing it at various times. I guess I've been fortunate to catch the tail end of certain people's career. I had had the good fortune to play with McCoy Tyner, of course, he's still going strong, and Joe Henderson, who's no longer with us, so we played together quite a bit. Also played with Freddie Hubbard before his chops went down. And those were all great experiences. I think I may have missed the golden era for really playing with a lot of those people. If I had made different choices in my life, I perhaps could have gotten more of those opportunities. But, yeah, I have a wish list. There's no question there.
You know, while listening to your recordings, I'm always struck by how you may have been influenced by maybe Gil Evans or George Russell, especially when it comes to arranging. Now, this is a gut feeling I have always had regarding your music. Am I off base here?
I really appreciate your comparing me to great arrangers and composers such as Gil Evans and George Russell. I really would not put myself anywhere near their league, but yes, I have been influenced highly by them, particularly Gil. And I would love to write more large-scale works in those kind of styles. My arranging is basically pragmatic. I arrange because I have to. I have to do it. I'm the one that putting these projects together, and I'm adapting the music for the musicians at hand. Fortunately, there were some pretty great musicians, including Dizzy and Joe Henderson and Howard Johnson and people of this caliber. So it's kind of natural that I would take the same approach. Also, I'd say Duke Ellington is probably a really strong influence on me as well as an arranger and orchestrator, that you take music and you adapt it for the players that are going to play it. I think that's the most important part. But I always loved voicings, and I used to work with Tom Harrell quite a bit, and we would sit around and discuss these things, and he would show me his concept of voicings. He always had a very advanced harmonic concept and how to make things sound really good. I think that's the key to arranging, is to make it sound good and then to put it together in such a way that it makes for very complete performances when you're recording. Recordings being kind of snapshots of things and arrangements being kind of springboards for things to happen. So, again, thank you for comparing me to those guys. I'll keep trying harder.
You know, the 1940s was a great period for jazz. So many players and ideas were being discussed on the bandstand. It was certainly a transitional period for the music. Do you ever wish that you were part of that scene?
Yeah, sure. The 1940s. I was born in 1942, so I couldn't have been too active with the music scene at that time. But I got to say, I've imagined many times what it would have been like to be around people in double-breasted pinstripe suits playing bebop in New York and elsewhere. Certainly a young Benny Carter was around and very active, and I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall around some of those scenes, because just about everybody played with him, even Dizzy and not necessarily Charlie Parker, although they played together later on, but Max Roach and J.J. Johnson were all in his bands, and I would imagine sitting around hearing some conversations about things, what that must have been like. So, yeah, your imagination can run wild, you know, but that's about it. I wasn't there. Would have liked to have been, though.
Benny Carter, now there's a name that you admire greatly. Was he involved in your tribute recording to him?
Well, sure, Benny Carter was directly involved. He actually played on three of the tracks on my recording of his music, because primarily we recorded a whole evening's worth of music at Yoshi's during one of our quintet performances with Roger Kellaway and Harold Jones and Jeff Chambers and Benny and myself. In fact, there is an album's worth of material. If there's anybody listening that would like to release it, come talk to me. But I had also toured with him extensively, as well as played with him in small groups, and was in his big band. Many of his compositions are charted, so I became more aware of his fantastic composing abilities and how great his tunes were, having played them on two Japanese tours and some other big band occasions that we did up here. He's always very generous in supplying lead sheets for his songs, so that was easy to get a hold of. Just call him up and he'd send them up. And, he didn't really direct anything else about the recording. In fact, I hope he liked it. I think he did. I'm not really quite certain. Benny's a very fussy musician. I think he maybe wasn't all that happy about some of the reharmonizations I might have done. He's very particular about his chord changes. But again, I'm left to speculate. Benny's such a nice person, he would never say anything about it. He did teach me a couple of things about his tunes. One of his tunes, which didn't end up on the album, but which I did record on and played with him on regular occasions, is called People Time. I think Stan Getz recorded. And I would often extemporaneously rephrase the melody to the end of the song where... And he would point out to me, he'd tell me, you know, I'd take him back to his hotel or something, he'd say, you know, Mel, at the end of that tune goes, people, time, it's a triplet, and you're not doing that. So he kind of slapped me around in the nicest possible way with only real love and care. But he definitely helped me to understand how to play his music. And just, of course, being around him and playing it was the main lessons and the real direction that I needed.
Who are your main influences in regards to playing and writing?
It's kind of hard to talk about what are the main influences in regards to one's playing and writing. Often you write a composition and you go, you know, I have no idea where that came from. I've always tried to kind of aim my compositions and aim and name my compositions about things and people in my life and influences in my life. But, you know, when you're writing the music, you don't sit there and go, now I want this to kind of reflect that. Except on rare occasions. I have a song on my most recent album called For Duke and Mingus, but I actually wasn't thinking about Mingus. It's only later that people pointed out that it has a Mingus quality. I was thinking about Duke because it was written upon his death, and I was definitely thinking of the kinds of moods and the kinds of things he might have put into a composition, so there was a conscious effort in that tune. But often I just write a song and see what it sounds like and then kind of name it after that. So it can work in a lot of different ways. In regards to my playing influences, well, I keep forgetting that maybe not everybody knows who everybody else is, but most musicians know who the great influences are, and those are the people that have influenced me. Many cases from an early age on record and of that nature, but then later on I got closer to people, Dizzy and Benny and Joe Henderson and Freddie Hubbard, and those people are all influences on me, McCoy Tyner. Certainly a lot of John Coltrane, and I'm actually listening to more John Coltrane right now than I have in a long time, with all the reissues of his work going on. Certainly Sonny Rollins, certainly Miles' playing and his bands are all an influence. It's hard to say. I actually have to kind of leave that, pick that out, let other people pick that out. I did see one review of my new record where somebody said that I was kind of a conjunction of Joe Henderson's Off the Wall playing with Dexter Gordon's Drive, something to that effect. And I actually kind of appreciate that comment because Dexter Gordon's always been an influence, and so is Joe Henderson. And it would be my desire to be able to put those influences into something, but mainly hope that it is something of my own.
You know, Mel, I remember reading years ago that Dexter Gordon was in a bus station and that he'd heard some noises coming from the sound of the buses moving. Now, the sound was rhythmic in nature. This inspired him to write a tune based on what he'd heard. Now, do you get inspired from various sources?
Yeah, a lot of sources are sources of inspiration, and I think musicians that really know how to hear and that really listen closely listen to all sorts of things. I mean, Eric Dolphy was known to go out and play with the birds. I mean, literally the birds, not the band. I had remember coming out of hearing a concert by Ornette Coleman with two basses, and I was standing in the street, and the traffic in the street sounded pretty much like the music I had just been listening to. And That was interesting. I don't know if it would influence anything I ever did. But you listen to the sounds of nature. I remember going out and listening to mountains. I could hear the sounds that mountains would make. It was a rather low, deep rumbling sound, and perhaps I thought there was going to be an eruption soon or something. But there's a lot of things in the world that you hear. And sure, you go into the big cities and there's buses, there's traffic, there's all kinds of things going on. But we hear everything, and that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to let everything come in. But it's often visual, too, as well. I remember hearing Duke Ellington play up on Mount Tamalpais here in Marin County, where I live, once with his orchestra, and he was standing around while the orchestra was playing. He was just looking at this fantastic view of the bay and the Golden Gate Bridge, and it's such a beautiful place. And I knew he was just gaining inspiration. He was one that always wrote from inspiration of his travels, the Far East Suite and so forth. And he would always write about things that influenced him in that way. So it's visual as well as audible.
What music did you listen to growing up?
When I was growing up, I used to listen to the radio, one of those little Crosley AM radios. And I would tune it in very softly at night and listen to a local jazz station, not a local jazz station, but a local radio station with a local jazz program. And the name of that program was Jazz Rhythm and Blues, and it was run by a guy named Glenn Churches, and he would play a lot of those recordings that were going on in the 50s with Dave Brubeck and Jerry Mulligan and Miles and various things, and it was a very hip show, and those sounds caught my ears, most definitely. As I mentioned earlier, also, I got into playing little 45 records, and one of the first records I ever got was Benny Goodman at Carnegie Hall. And subsequently, many other little 45 records, including the jam sessions on Capitol Records that were recorded in the studios at late at night, that featured players like Shelly Mann, Frank Rosalino, and, of course, Mr. Benny Carter. So his sound was right there from the beginning in my ears, and definitely an influence. So, and I also listened to a lot of classical music. As I mentioned, my mother was involved with that, and I would practice classical clarinet and later flute and listen to classical music on the radio and different recordings of things, and I really enjoyed listening to it. It was never really my desire to perform that music, but definitely classical music is an influence, and it still is to this day.
Do you ever listen to older recordings to learn maybe a new technique or an idea that you might want to incorporate into what you're doing now?
I listen to all kinds of recordings, and I listen in all kinds of ways, often not analytical. I prefer to just listen for music. I used to listen much more analytically and derive my influences from that. I think at this later stage in my development that I don't do it that way. I'm really just trying to come up with my own ideas as I can. However, again, I've been listening to a lot of John Coltrane, and that is a good example. I'm finding things and moods, and particularly the album Crescent and the reissue of the Love Supreme record, and preparing to record a duo album with pianist Charles Eubanks, and I'm finding that a lot of those kinds of moods, Lonnie's Lament, those kinds of tunes open up a real reflective side of John Coltrane that might be perfect for this duo project that we're going to do. But Coltrane was a master at capturing those kinds of moods, very thoughtful, very reflective. And that's a great thing to be influenced by, so I'm opening myself to that. And, of course, to listen to say Jimmy Heath's big band arrangements, and Jimmy's a friend of mine. We talked. He's actually going to send out a few of his charts for me to use in my school clinics that I do in different situations. So I'd like to be playing his music, but he's always been an influence and one of the first people that taught me how to use computers to arrange and do stuff. So there's a lot of things, and of course, just any great record, old or new, it should be timeless. If it's a great record, it should be a timeless recording that you can listen to at any time and get something new out of. So yeah, I listen to all kinds of things periodically. Sometimes I don't listen to music at all. I don't really want to hear that much music because I'm just trying to hear the music that I'm dealing with, and so sometimes better to tune stuff out. As you know, I've done a lot of writing over the years, and some of that's been reviewing records. I've since sort of stopped that for a while because of that reason. I really don't want to listen in that kind of depth, because when you're reviewing a record, you listen very critically and very analytically and in great depth to every moment of the record. And sometimes you're not really enjoying them necessarily. You're kind of forced to be in that situation. And I found that's something I really don't want to be doing right now.
Do you look for situations that may be musically challenging to you?
I
know that as a jazz musician, this can be a lifelong quest.
I'm not really looking necessarily for things that are musically challenging to me, although going to New York often presents those opportunities. Sometimes out here in California, I am presented with those opportunities as well, but not as often. I'm actually looking for situations that are musically satisfying to me. That's actually more my quest, is to work with musicians and keep my bands together that offer me a certain level of satisfaction. Essentially, that comes from bands that really swing and with musicians that have a real depth of experience and a lot to say. And that's actually hard to do anywhere. It's hard to do here, but it's hard to do in New York too. And it does still happen, and I am still able to do that. So there's a lot of different kinds of projects that I would be involved in, but if I don't get a certain satisfaction, I don't bother with it, because it's not fun. It's not fun in the way that I found you can have fun playing with musicians like Dizzy and Benny Carter and all the people I've played with that have always shown me that playing music is supposed to be fun, and having that fun is the greatest satisfaction there is. If I'm playing with a bunch of people that are serious musicians but not really getting it on and really having that much enjoyment out of what they're doing, it's not something that I want to repeat. I might occasionally check some stuff out, but it's basically not that at all. A musical challenge doesn't come up as much as it used to. I guess either I've gotten better or there are fewer musical challenges, and I'm not sure which one of those is coming first, but I don't really find that many musical challenges in the same sense as I may have used to, in terms of having to master something or to get something really together in order to present something. It's really not that. I think the biggest challenge is finding enough outlets, enough work, where I can do the kind of gigs I want to do. I'm at a stage where I'm not doing gigs I don't want to do. I'm not just playing anything that comes up, because there's not that many opportunities where I live, and even New York, there's fewer opportunities to really do what you want to do. So you kind of got to pick and choose a little bit.
Let's talk about dream bands. If you were to form a dream band, who would it consist of, and what pieces would you choose if you were to make a recording?
Well, let's see. If I had a dream band, and I think we discussed the idea that it could be anybody living or not living, that would be tough, because, first of all, a band is chemistry. So I don't know if everybody I'd want in the band could play together that well. It may not be a compatible band at all. So let's not try and make that band, because you really wouldn't know till you had it. But if I had a band, it would be the people that were important to me that I would want in it. And that would be, I'd like to have Dizzy Gillespie playing the trumpet. I'd like to have Benny Carter playing the alto saxophone. I'd like to have Joe Henderson and Dexter Gordon in the band, too, just to have a couple other tenor players in there to mess around with. On drums, I'd love to have Elvin Jones, because I've never played with Elvin Jones. I'd love to play with Elvin Jones, so I'd like to get him on drums. Unfortunately, I missed any opportunities to play with Mr. Ray Brown on bass, but I would think Ray Brown on bass would be just about heaven under any circumstances. On piano, yeah, I could dig McCoy Tyner. That would be great, because I have played with him, and I think he's wonderful, and I'd like to hear him play with all these other guys. That would be interesting. So, yeah, maybe guys like that. Maybe we could get J.J. Johnson on trombone. That's another one. So I guess I would veer toward the older guys. And maybe some younger ones that I would be interested in. I think that'd be another band, though.
What make of sax do you play?
Well, thank you for asking me what type of saxophone I play. because it just so happens I'm one of the main and chief endorsers for a long time for Yanagisawa saxophones, which in North America are distributed by G. LeBlanc Corporation. When I was touring Japan in the early 90s, the two tours I did with Ben and Carter, I was able to go to the Yanagisawa factory in Tokyo, and that was a very enlightening experience. I had been checking out their instruments and eventually got one of their curved sopranos because they definitely make one of the best curved sopranos ever that has ever been out there. And I was so impressed with that horn, I eventually got one of their tenors. And when I saw the quality control and the real care and dedication they have into making their instruments, it was very, very enlightening to me. And I have since converted to that brand of saxophones completely. They make a lot of saxophones out of different materials. The ones I play have solid silver bodies and necks, brass bells, gold plating on various parts of it, the neck, and now I put it on my tenor bell. And they make a bronze saxophone, which I remember seeing prototypes of, which is quite a wonderful instrument. Now they put that into production. I have one of those on for tenor. And they're just marvelous saxophones, some of the best saxophones that I've ever seen in my life. The interesting part is that the quality control is so high, you can play 10 out of 10 and find 10 good ones. They're all very, very fine. They're like custom-made saxophones. They fit the keys right from the beginning of the process. Those keys stay with that horn, and that horn is a custom-made horn by the time it gets to the end of the production line. And the pad work lasts a long time, so they're just really the most wonderful saxophones, and I'm now being quoted as saying they're the finest saxophone players and finest saxophones in the world. I don't know about the saxophone player, but he tries pretty hard too.
This is a question I love to ask. If you were stranded on a desert island, what 10 recordings would you bring?
If I were stranded on a desert island, which I hope I'm not, and I would like to take my laptop with me and some kind of wireless internet connectivity, but other than that, if I could only bring 10 recordings along, it would probably be the following, but this is always subject to change if I have choices, and not necessarily in this order, but by Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, and Miles Ahead are indispensable. Charlie Parker at the Rockland Palace, because it's a live, stretched-out bird, unlike anything he ever did in a studio. Vladimir Horowitz plays Rachmaninoff because there's not anything stronger emotionally than you can listen to by any pianist anywhere. Art Tatum meets Ben Webster because it's Art Tatum meets Ben Webster. Anything of Lester Young with Count Basie, particularly from the late 30s, which is a revolutionary saxophone, not just evolutionary. That was out of nowhere, that stuff. By John Coltrane, A Love Supreme and Crescent are indispensable because of what they are. A Love Supreme being one of the strongest spiritual recordings he ever made, and Crescent being one of the more reflective recordings he ever made. I've added a tenor saxophonist that is the only classical tenor saxophone soloist. His name is James Hulick, and he is an amazing performer of contemporary composition on the tenor saxophone. He's very fantastic. And finally, Monk's Dream, only because I just happened to have bought one of the repackaged versions of that record, and it's one of my favorites, but there are so many Monk records, but I'd have to have some Monk in there. So those are the 10, if I'm limited to just 10. Of course, if I have my laptop, I can carry like thousands of MP3 files, right? So that would work.
You know, the internet has played a key role for many musicians. How has this new paradigm affected your relation with your fans?
Well, I have a kind of mixed feelings about the emergence of the internet and how that's affected things in terms of maintaining a fan base. It certainly made it easier in terms of, making your bios available, making your recordings available, and to send out emails and mail lists to people for gigs and that sort of thing. Keeping newsletters out there. Yeah, it has helped. The better people have full-time people at that. And the bigger companies, they have people they hire. That's all they do. I don't have as much time or interest to be sitting in front of a computer doing that sort of thing. And I'm a little reticent to be hustling everybody that I can via emails, as we're all way overloaded already with so much junk mail. So I actually have kind of kept that a little more minimal than some people have. Some people are experts and really keep pushing that envelope, and that's great. I mean, the Internet's obviously become one of the major communication tools that we have since the advent of the telephone, really. I mean, if you're not doing email now, you're almost out of it. And I do know a couple of people that don't. So, and then even some people that have it don't read it that much. So it doesn't affect everybody. I'd rather be practicing my saxophone, to be really honest.
Aside from playing, Mel, are you active in teaching? For example, giving clinics or sessions, traveling around the country?
Well, as you know, teaching jazz is big business now. The IAJE is huge. The conventions draw over 7,000 people every year. Every school has some sort of jazz program. And yes, I have always been active as a teacher. I've been on adjunct faculties to a number of the universities out here. I'm not a professional teacher in that I don't have a degree. I've done things off my professional experiences as a musician. I've gotten recently some grants to do hands-on teaching of jazz in the schools. It's an interesting paradox, because we're actually trying to teach something that's not all that teachable. I think it's great that people try and learn it, because I think it helps musicianship. I think everybody can learn from it. But students now are so inundated with materials and choices that it's actually getting hard to teach in a real focused, useful way. And I'm always looking for the most useful things that I can offer them that will help them to learn this art form. Real players are going to be playing. Actually, you can't do anything to discourage them. It's many of the others that are just want to do it and are trying to do it that are harder to teach. That's because they don't necessarily have all that much talent for it. So, yeah, I teach. I do a lot of clinics, and I am a professional clinician. I go around the country and do these sorts of things. And I enjoy it. I really enjoy it for a simple reason. I enjoy people, and I enjoy talking to them about what I do and what we do and what I've done with all the great musicians I've done it with. And I think that if anybody can get anything out of it, well, then that's a plus. If they get more than that, then that's really good. So we keep working with musicians, and I'm always looking for the younger musicians that are really starting to do it and showing that they can do it. Unfortunately, the media tends to explode on a lot of people's careers before they're really ready. They may not even have the real goods yet. So although many of the people that we admired early on started young and had identities of their own very young, and so I'm always looking for the real originals and the people that are really going to do this. Whether I can teach them anything or not, that remains to be seen. All you can do is put it out there. As Joe Henderson used to say, you just sort of plant your seeds along the way and see what comes up. But things will come up. The music will survive, definitely. It's unfortunate that it seems to be a situation now where there's more people making records than there are to listen to them, because it's really making it difficult to sell any records to anybody. I think the technology has kind of defeated a lot of that, in that people, if they like something, they can burn it and pass it on to their friends. This is not quite the same as taping stuff off the radio as we used to do, or getting interested in something and just really going out and buying a record. So times have changed, and we'll see what happens.
In terms of the future, what plans do you have regarding recordings and maybe various projects?
The plans that I have currently are to record an album with, as I mentioned, Charles Eubanks, a great pianist out of New York, pretty well unknown, not really one of the Eubanks brothers. However, he was in the Eubanks family band at one point, so they all know who each other are. Charles often plays with Dewey Redman and is from Detroit, and is a great combination of bebop and a little more cutting-edge kind of playing. I hate to use the term experimental because that's not really what he does. But he and I roomed together for a while in New York and used to practice a lot and did some gigs and recorded some live broadcasts. And Bob Roush at Cadence North Country, who distributes my Bebop and Beyond album, liked something I sent him that we did and asked us to record. So we'll be doing that in June, so I'm kind of looking forward to that project. Really don't have other projects in mind at this time, although I've been working with a friend of mine out here named Peter Welker and doing a few sessions with Bill Watrous and Herb Pomeroy, Fred Lipsius, and some other musicians from out here. So I've been enjoying doing that. Eventually that album will be out. So that's it for now, and of course, Randy, I will let you know of any newer projects that come after that.
Over your lifetime, Mel, you must have encountered many musical stories that were actually quite funny. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on that, and if you have a few that you'd like to share with us.
Well, I can tell you a couple of the things that happened with Dizzy Gillespie that were pretty funny. One time when we played at the Monterey Jazz Festival together, Dizzy had a cold and they kept feeding him shots of cognac. So by the end of the set, he was five sheets to the wind, so to speak, and was feeling pretty loose. And we were standing around at the back door of the venue. He was waiting for his car to come pick him up, which was called Old Yellow, which was driven by a friend of his. And it was an old yellow Cadillac. And they'd drive him around in this old yellow Cadillac. And Dizzy was pretty juiced at that point, and we had done a lot of this work together. We'd played and recorded by then, and he was looking at me and going, he says, you know, Mel, he says, I ought to kick your ass. I'm going to kick it right over there on that spot, right there on the ground. And I said, I knew the other shoe was going to drop. We've been having too much fun. Another time we were on stage, and he turned around to Donald Bailey, the drummer, and said, hit that cymbal right there on that spot. Which is, if you were playing drums, that would be a pretty strange thing to have somebody tell you, you know. Then there was the concert where he came out 15 minutes late because they wouldn't let him use the upstairs bathroom at the Herbst Theater. And needless to say, I have this whole thing on videotape to prove it, but needless to say, Dizzy Gillespie was not a happy camper about this situation, and he went on to the audience about everything that happened and why this little guard wouldn't let him in the bathroom, and then because he had taken these five laxatives and he couldn't go back on stage until he had taken care of his business, which he explained in thorough detail to the audience. And at the very end, he said, I won't say it in the blunt language he said it, but he said his punchline to this was, I could just see the headlines tomorrow. Dizzy Gillespie takes a dump and the whole audience leaves. That was a pretty funny story.
With the recent passing of Mongo Santamaria, what was it like playing with him?
The record that I did with Mongo Santamaria, I actually overdubbed in California. It was recorded elsewhere. I didn't see him in the studio. I had played with him many years prior when I was playing with Pete and Coke Escovedo in San Francisco, and Mongo came and sat in, and he liked my playing, and he kind of hinted that he might like it if I called him to work with him or something of that nature. Would I be interested in going on the road, which at the time I wasn't because I was just starting my young family. So I never really played with him that much, but I always appreciated his work. I used to hear Cal Jader, he had a great band with Mongo Santamaria, Willie Bobo, Vince Guaraldi, and Al McKibben. And that was an incredible band. Sometimes he'd have Paul Horn playing with him, too. So that was an incredible band. It was very influential. It was one of the early bands I heard in Sacramento. But it was great being on one of his records. I certainly appreciated that.
Mel, I'd like to thank you for dropping by today and sharing some of your thoughts and experiences with us on this very special edition of In Transition.
Thank you for having me, Randy. I've really appreciated this chat and having the chance to talk to you about many of the things that have happened in my life. Take care. See you again. Bye-bye.